busybodies. Welcome to another episode of The Busyness Paradox. I'm Frank Butler, here with Paul Harvey.
Good day.
And what are we discussing on today's show, Paul?
Crap jobs.
Oh.
I always pick the fun ones. Crap jobs.
Yeah, no. This is interesting.
The paradox of crap jobs. And also, like, the paradox of non-crap jobs. We should really come up with a more elegant way of stating all this, but that's what I want to talk about. Crap jobs, not crap jobs, and the interesting things that are happening in both of those ends of the job spectrum right now. But first, I think we've got some fun new busy bites to chew through.
Yes, we do, actually. The first one, the question came up a few weeks ago about, can my employer force me to not wear a mask? And at that time, the CDC guidelines had specified that the employer cannot actually make you not wear a mask. Because the guidelines of the CDC were the way they were, you actually have some buffer, some protection because of the CDC guidelines. But now they've changed, right? Now we're seeing a transition in those guidelines. We're seeing masks not being required if you're vaccinated and so on. However, there are still mandates about, or at least guidelines rather, and it says basically if you're not vaccinated, you should consider wearing one, etc. So I would say right now we're looking at an environment where, because the CDC guidelines have changed, and even state guidelines from the health departments of the state levels have changed, those protections of saying, hey, can my employer force me to not wear a mask has changed, which means basically they probably can at this point, especially if you're vaccinated. Again, state dependent, what have you. Now, obviously, you could push back and say, no, I'm going to wear one. But at the same time, if you're at an at-will state, you know, you do this at your own peril, I think.
Yeah, you're not going to get fired for wearing a mask, but maybe you suddenly lose your job for some other reason. And you're in an at-will state. Of course, this is all in the U.S. context that we're talking about here. You're in an at-will state, and now the burden is on you to prove that you got fired for your desire to wear a mask. And as abstract and weird as this sounds, it has happened. There was this example a few weeks ago. A tax preparation office in Massachusetts did exactly that, wouldn't allow employees or customers to wear masks.
And let's note, that's still when the CDC guidelines were saying
yes,
everybody should wear masks.
Right. So. They were fined, says, $136,000, I think. That fine probably wouldn't happen now that the CDC guidelines are gone. I think it's more likely that you would see the kind of pressure to not wear a mask in more overtly customer-facing occupations, maybe staff at a restaurant, something like that.
Right.
So as weird as it sounds that this could actually happen, it is sort of happening. Sometimes with some logic to it, sometimes it's just silly political stuff, who knows. But it's becoming an issue, so we thought we'd mention it.
No, absolutely. I figured we'd give you some clarity on it. Sometimes I feel uncomfortable not being masked. I am vaccinated, but there are some occasions I'm like, there's too many people in here. I'm just going to throw it on just in case. Because there are cases of breakthrough, basically being vaccinated, but still getting that. Bill Maher, for example, is vaccinated. He was recently diagnosed with having COVID.
Really?
Now, the idea is that the vaccine's supposed to help you not experience the symptoms. Yeah, it literally, I think I saw that story the other day, 2 or 3 days ago about Bill Maher. But basically, yeah, having that vaccine, you can still get it in some conditions.
Yeah.
And if you do, the symptoms are not supposed to be as severe. So there's that element. It's a precaution.
That's right. We've been wearing them for a year. What's a few more weeks? We're used to it now. What's the big deal?
Yeah, I would like to see more people getting vaccinated, quite honestly. The more the virus has an opportunity to infect someone, the higher the likelihood it has to create a new variant.
And mutate.
Which could become vaccine resistant.
Sure.
And so on. And I think that segues nicely into the idea of requiring vaccinations, whether it's at universities or at schools, even at workplaces. In order to work there, you have to be vaccinated. Can they make you do that? It depends on the context. I think state level, it becomes a little bit trickier because it's state by state and so on. But private organizations can make those decisions.
I think as it stands now, even we both work at state universities, I believe they have the latitude right now to make the call themselves. I think even public schools can decide on their own if it's something they want to pursue or not. I know the CDC has said that they're not getting in this mess. Their recommendation is that everyone get vaccinated and that's it. They're not making any recommendations on requirements.
Right. And our university, for example, or at least our board has determined that the university system is not going to require vaccines or vaccinations for the faculty, staff, and students.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they recommend it, but it's not required. And this is one of those things that comes up because some people are upset about it, right? Some people want them to be required. Other people are like, no, you shouldn't get it. You know, it's an untested, whatever. There's a lot of different factions and views on it. But at the end of the day, we can still require people to have certain vaccines. So coming to a university, for example, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, the MMR, is a requirement. You have to have been vaccinated against those. Now, obviously, there are some religious reasons why you can choose not to, or health concerns to avoid a vaccine. Yeah. But for the most part, you have to have that vaccine to come to a university. And given that we are not a required organization, we do have a little bit more latitude or leeway on these kinds of things. And by not required, I mean, you have the option of not going to a higher education institution after you're finished with high school. The law requires you to go through high school, I think, for the most part, again, with exemptions.
Yeah, 16.
But college is optional.
Yeah. And there's, again, we're talking about the U.S. There's so many colleges. If you don't want to get the vaccine and school A says you have to, there's a school B, C, and W that don't require it. So even if you want to go, you still have choice of where to go.
Exactly. And this is what kills me. So there's a private school here in town. It's a highly reputed institution. And they've said that they're going to require faculty and students to get vaccinated. And there are parents who are upset about it. And my thought is simply, you have plenty of money to afford this tuition. It's not cheap. You can send your kid literally anywhere. You don't like it? Send them somewhere else. Or send them to public school.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen. But I mean, you could.
Yep.
So stop complaining about it. You don't like it? You get to spend your money how you want to. You get to make that decision. You might like the school. If you want to keep your kid in that school, then get vaccinated. They've made that decision. It is up to you to make the decision as to whether or not you think that's valid, or buy something else.
Yeah. You cannot force your weird anti-vaccination policies on everyone else at a private institution. So go home.
Exactly. The whole thing is that it's a private institution. They can make their own choices. I think what's been interesting, though, with the face mask end of things, is that the flu has been very low this year. We've seen a low uptick in flu. I've seen a low, or I've heard as well, there's a low uptick in colds. I mean, not uptick. The colds have gone down, right?
Yep.
So the spreading of viruses, like the flu virus, like the cold virus, have gone down tremendously because we're wearing face masks.
I didn't get to my wife, who's a nurse, chagrin, I did not get a flu shot this year because my doctor told me I'm still like in the latter stages of recovering from this weird tick infection thing. He said, basically, you can get a flu shot, but you know, it's going to make you feel like garbage because of everything else you got going on in your system. And he said, you know, I'm not going to tell you to do it or not do it. I asked him, I said, well, everyone's wearing masks and staying 6 feet apart and all the social distancing. Like, seems like this is the year that there's not going to be so much to worry about in terms of getting the flu. But to listen to the news, it was like, oh my God, this is predicted to be the worst flu year ever. I'm just like, how is it going to be the worst flu year ever if we're all staying inside and not going near each other and wearing masks and
washing
our hands? So I didn't get the flu shot for that reason. And then that's how it turned out. So I think we're going to see masks going forward, like just like they have in Asia for a long time now, because not getting the flu, not getting colds is nice.
No, it is nice. And I mean, that's how you eliminate some of these viruses. Again, the MMR vaccine has eliminated, for the most part, polio and mumps and so on, except for in those areas
that's the polio vaccine
tend to be the polio vaccine too. But we've seen like measles pop up in areas where there's a large anti-vaccine faction, and you see measles crop up in those areas, but not
any mumps. The hell gets mumps in this day and age? Yeah, starting to see mumps again.
Right. It just blows my mind. It's like these things work. These things truly work. And I know people are like, oh, we're just guinea pigs. They've been testing this stuff for years in terms of how they administered the mRNA. That's the first mRNA vaccine. But this stuff has been actually vetted in other ways.
Every human being that's ever lived has been a guinea pig so that we can have what we have today. And so, yeah, we are guinea pigs to some degree. You know, they're figuring out stuff that will help future generations too.
Exactly. I would have actually signed up to be in the trial phase even
just
because.
I wouldn't have because of my tick stuff, but
well, you have a medical reason not to do so for sure.
Ordinarily, I would have,
Right. Anyway, so those are two things that kind of stood out and we wanted to address. Now, another one that's a little bit of a shift, it is related to the impact the pandemic has had, but not due to COVID or vaccines or anything, was HSBC Bank has actually gotten rid of their entire executive floor in their London headquarters. And what they've done instead is they're going to a hot desk, I believe they called it. Yeah, hot desk on an open floor plan for executives. Now, I don't want to get too deep into the open floor plan idea and how terrible it is and how it doesn't work. And there's plenty of research that doesn't support it. But more focus on the idea that I think this is going to become more and more common for a lot of companies is this idea of hybrid work environments, because that's one of the things HSBC said. And another thing is they always had a lot of empty offices because a lot of their executives are traveling a lot. So why do you have all this unnecessary space when you can create this quote unquote hot desk environment where people use the space that's available instead of just having fixed space all the time and people aren't there? So I think this is a trend that's accelerated more so due to the pandemic. It's interesting and it has some cost savings elements to it.
It's fascinating because I think this is a trend that was kind of starting to die out. Like the open office fad had kind of run its course and people were coming to the conclusion by and large that, nah, this isn't that good. But the idea is that it fosters a more collaborative environment with less hierarchy and you don't have the symbols of hierarchical levels like the boss with the closed door and everyone else in their cubicle farm. Like, in theory, it makes sense. In practice, like you said, it's kind of lame. But all of a sudden, we got this pandemic thing that's starting to make the economics of it a lot more sensible.
Right.
It seems to me that it's making like a kind of surprise comeback.
Right. It really is. And it makes sense in this context if you're not there all the time, right? I feel like that's not going to be so bad as it would be if it was your work environment every day. And so I could see this, especially if you're in a hybrid work environment where you're maybe in the office 1 or 2 days a week and you're traveling other days. It doesn't seem like it would be that interfering. And I think there's some benefits in this case, which is you get FaceTime and be able to talk to others and really share what you're doing, what you're working on. It could be really good for collaboration and ideation or whatever people like to call this idea generation stuff, creativity type of activities. So I think there's some benefit to this.
And you can talk to people without worrying about breathing the same air so much if you're in a cubicle together having a meeting or even an office.
Right.
This pandemic thing, we probably would have been able to work more collaboratively if we had more of these open office spaces, you could say, because you can stand like 10 feet apart and not have a wall between you.
Yeah, exactly. And just to kind of round that out, HSBC says they're looking to reduce 40% of their office space. If you guys know HSBC, they're a global large bank. They're one of the big ones.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting what's going on. Somewhat related to the pandemic, there's our next series of, or our, really the topic for today's episode. I want to start with what kind of is the busy bite in a sense, which is this idea of labor shortage or terrible jobs. Right now, we're seeing a huge glut of workers filling in some of these quote unquote essential jobs or minimum wage type jobs. And I've seen this impact ripple through. So my wife, for example, my wife and I, rather, we use Home Chef. And that's one of those, send you a pack of meals, 3-4 days of meals, dinners. We prepare them. They're great. Well, they canceled our order on us this past week because they didn't have enough people to pack these things and ship them out. A buddy of mine, his company, they're paying $1,000 signing bonus for their line worker jobs, basically. They're not minimum wage paying, but the whole thing is being driven that unemployment is paying a little bit more than some of these jobs. And we're talking about unemployment's paying close to $15 an hour at the moment between the federal support and the state support. Close, not quite, but close.
Varies by state and such, but.
Right.
And this is, of course, in the U.S. that we're talking about here.
Right. For our international listeners, I know we have those in countries like New Zealand, China. I've seen Cyprus, which is very cool. UK, Germany listeners. We appreciate everybody who's listening to our show from all over the world. Again, our show tends to be a little bit focused on what's going on here in the U.S., but both Paul and I have good international experience, so we can sometimes contextualize some of these things too, to discuss what other countries are doing a little differently than we might be.
This is not one of those times. I don't know how unemployment benefits work in other countries.
I would say that my experience was with Germany, seeing it happen in Germany and actually in the UK when we dismissed people. People were a little bit less concerned about being fired or laid off in those environments because I think partially they had health insurance and they were being taken care of. But I also think that those countries have done a little bit better job.
The impression we get is that every other country does it better. In my experience, in other countries has not always borne that out, but a lot of them do, obviously.
I think we could do better for sure, yeah. But...
No, we are doing apparently pretty good right now, better than we usually do.
No, I think we're doing right now.
And that's what brought this topic to our attention, the phenomenon that their unemployment benefits or unemployment compensation for a lot of folks right now is just enough that they don't need to take the crap jobs. They can say, I'm going to take my unemployment and hold out for something better. Kind of an unforeseen consequence that, depending on your perspective, is either good or bad. I think it's kind of a good thing. That it's not really enough to quote unquote live on, and nor is it designed to be, for at least not for a long term. But making sure people have enough financial security to maintain their human dignity is kind of a win, I think.
I agree.
And I gotta say, this is not in line with, you know, what has historically been my perspective on this stuff. Like the whole idea of a basic, what do you call that? A basic living. No. What do you call that when everyone in a country gets paid a certain amount of money just for like existing?
Oh, you mean like a universal basic income?
Yes, universal basic income. I always thought like a true American, that was just madness. But things like this kind of make you think a little bit that providing a base level of security does kind of take a lot of bad stuff out of the equation. And for our purposes, it puts more pressure on companies and managers to treat employees at the low end of the pay scale better than they traditionally have in a lot of cases.
See, that's the key. Like, I keep thinking about that aspect of it. If they had created a good work environment, if they hadn't maybe required too much work, not enough downtime, or no stimulus in the actual day in itself, if you're on the line and you're doing the same thing over and over again, and you're getting limited breaks, it's tedious. It's not stimulating. It's not helping you grow. There's no benefit to you to continue doing that necessarily or anything. So I feel like this shortage in a lot of cases is really weeding out maybe some of the worst cultures of companies too that really shouldn't exist to begin with.
Right. And we're seeing in the article that you're mentioning here, examples of restaurant owners they particularly kind of pick on, posting things on social media saying, you know, people are lazy, they don't want to work. I can't get anyone to even interview for my dishwasher job or whatever. And you've seen the responses like, nope, you just haven't made that job a job anyone actually wants. And so
right.
People don't have to take your job. They're not taking it. That's not a bad thing.
See, and that to me is what really is infuriating when people say, oh, people don't want to work. I don't think that's the case. I think people want to feel valued. They want to engage socially in some dimension, whether it's with coworkers or with customers, whatever it might be. I think people would love to work in a fast food job for the most part, if you're giving them something to work for beyond just crap pay.
My second favorite job of all time was at a fast food restaurant. I was 16, you know. It can be, almost any kind of work can be enjoyable if you put the effort into it. But as we've seen, that's not often done, especially when you know there's just always going to be somebody else filling out an application to take the place of everyone that you burn out and send out the door.
You know, kind of going that in that line, I remember seeing somewhere that McDonald's, I think, average employee tenure is something like 2 or 4 hours, or it used to be.
I don't know what the number is, but yeah, fast food for decades has just decided we're okay with 1,000% turnover rates.
It's bad. It doesn't make sense.
Makes your job harder as a manager. It makes your job harder. You're always right. Onboarding people. You're always training people.
I saw somewhere somebody had said something along the lines of paying people more, or they increased minimum wage in another country, and all it did was change the price of a hamburger at McDonald's, not hamburger, but like a Big Mac by 25 cents. And if you think about it, that's a small price to pay to give somebody a more fulfilling pay in itself, right? Somebody who can then maybe start taking care of themselves a little bit more and take care of their families or whatever that situation is, maybe not need to take a second job and not have time to help raise their kid, just having better things around them to help them improve their quality of life.
I mean, I still don't know that I like the living wage argument. There are some jobs I think you're not really meant to support yourself on. There are jobs that are really best done by teenagers moving through that phase of life and, you know, not basing a career on it. But yeah, as you spend a couple decades thinking about this stuff and you kind of wonder about the bigger picture cost of not keeping up with inflation and that sort of thing with minimum wage increases.
Yeah, here's just a quick stat. So You just mentioned minimum wage increases with inflation. This one actually is minimum wage has not kept up with productivity. And productivity, just talking about the money, I guess, we generate per employee, per hour, or something along those lines. But if we kept up with productivity, minimum wage should be about $24 and some change.
I always think you and I, we got the worst end of this deal. When we were that age of doing minimum wage type jobs in the mid-90s, we got the tail end of that really long stagnation where I think it was like 375 in the 80s or something, and it like crawled up to 425 and it stayed there for a long time. And then all of a sudden, late 90s, it started jumping up to like 8, 9, 10, 12, whatever dollars. Like, damn it, man. A year ago, I was doing that kind of work and you're making like $4 an hour more than me.
Yeah. But back then, at least for me, it taught me that I didn't want to make that little money. Yeah. But that's different. That's because I grew up with supportive parents that were middle class. Again, I can't say that it was something that I was going to be stuck doing necessarily, but it was a good lesson in the type of it was a good motivator for me because I had the support to do so. I know not everybody has that support. And that's something that, again, I feel like we need to be very cognizant of. If we want to get more for ourselves, we also have to help bring everybody else up with that. If that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a good point. The relative, you know, the perceptual angle I never really thought about. It's like we were broke as dirt with my mom and raising three kids. For me, that minimum wage job when I was 16, well, I was actually $4.50 an hour, so a quarter above minimum wage. To me, that was like just big money. Like I had cash in my pocket. Like if I wanted something, like a magazine, like I could buy it.
Right.
But you know, it's all relative, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that was it too for me at that age. It's like, oh, I could save up, you know, a week's salary at $4.25 an hour, which is what I was making. Actually, in one job, I was making technically less than minimum wage, which because I was getting paid weekly at, I think it was $150 a week. And it actually ended up being a 40-hour day. And then I would go work at UPS at night. You know,
you were on salary, man.
it was bad. And it eventually, like, they had me working so hard. The guy who was actually supposed to be running the program was putting in less time, making way more. And I kind of mutinied on him and he took a pay cut so I could get extra, which was nice, especially because at night I would go, I said UPS, I would work at what is now FedEx, but they were acquired by FedEx and it was called RPS.
I was going to say RPS. System. I knew a lot of people worked for RPS.
Yeah, I was there right at the UPS strike. So I would work that job at night. And originally I was just a loader. So I'd be a sort, like somebody would sort them out. We had three trucks in Savannah and I would be in one of the trucks loading it up. I learned Tetris that way, really. Like I think my Tetris skills came in really nicely. Pack a truck up where everything's nice and packed in so it's not going to fall over. But then UPS went on strike and we were going from handling about 500 to 800 packages a night to having to cap out at 5,000. And our unloader quit and I ended up being the unloader and I was unloading on average 5,000 packages a night and getting paid minimum wage. And it was brutal, right? I mean, it was brutal. It was a good lesson for me in a lot of ways. And as I get older, the more I reflect on, okay, it's one thing to be a college student or a high school student doing that job. Mm-hmm. It's a whole nother thing if your entire livelihood depends on it.
Yep.
I know a lot of people have that perspective of, hey, you know, I did the same crap as a high school student or I was in college and now I'm making, you know, six figures. Yay. Other people have to just go through that.
Right.
But that's not the reality. The reality is a lot of people are living this life well beyond high school or they can't go to college because of the situation they're facing with their families. And while I'm not a huge lover of the idea of universal basic income, I at least feel like we need to do better taking care of those frontline workers, especially now these essential workers, we're not doing anybody any favors. I think what we should have realized is saying, oh, look, they still have to go to work and put themselves at risk, not just themselves, their families at risk at the end of the day, because they had to go to work. There was no vaccine at the time. There was no treatments that we really had that were successful with battling COVID, yet they were still expected to go to work.
Yeah.
So I think that's the key is that people... It's not that people don't want to work. It's that
people don't want to put their life at risk for a small amount of money.
Yeah. Right. Or if they got laid off and they're finally being taken care of, that gives them a little bit more time to find a better fit for the risk that they're taking for really, truly terrible pay.
The counter argument is that the market dynamics should equalize things a little bit. Like very few places actually pay minimum wage in New Hampshire because of the cost of living. They won't fill the jobs that way, historically speaking. So just there is, you know, the argument you'll get is that, well, the market will take care of it. And in some cases it will. But if there's an endless line of people so desperate for a paycheck that they'll do this work for minimum wage, it won't always correct itself.
Exactly.
All right. We need to rein this in and talk about some other stuff. But before we do, I propose an intermission.
So folks, what we're going to do is we're going to play some intermission music from Monty Python's Quest for the Holy Grail. It's going to be 30 seconds long. So the moment you hear the song, there's usually a fast forward button for 30 seconds jump in your podcast app or even on the podcast website. So if you're going through Buzzsprout or what have you, just hit that 30 seconds the moment you hear the music and you'll be at the next section. So enjoy your break. And we're back, everybody. We were just talking about these market forces. We were really talking about minimum wage and how the market forces based on cost of living, different states, etc., were going on. So, Paul, let's pick up where we left off.
Yeah, so we have this paradoxical situation where unemployment is high while employers are understaffed. The supply is there, the demand's there, but they're not meeting in the middle because the supply doesn't want to work for what the demand is trying to pay. So they can afford, at least for a little while, to hold out because of the unemployment assistance. You know, wise economic minds can debate the pros and the cons of this government distortion of labor market equilibrium and all that. But I'm just thinking, and you know, I'm a fairly libertarian guy. I'm not saying yay government intervention here. I'm just thinking that if you're an employer and your wages can't compete with a measly unemployment check, maybe you need to rethink how you're running that aspect of your business. But then we've got a paradox on top of that paradox, where at the lower end of the pay scale, we have people working less than traditional economic theory might suggest, while at the other end, we have people working way more hours than their jobs actually require them to. That, of course, is the phenomenon from which our show gets its name. But the pandemic has kind of put a lot of this under the magnifying glass. That was the focus of our BS Jobs episode a while back, of course. So we've started seeing this kind of silly term, workism, popping up to describe, you know, the tendency of those in higher income salaried positions to work more and more hours, reversing the trend that we saw through most of the 20th century, where as you got more successful and more highly compensated, climbing the ladder and all that stuff, people would work less. You would spend more time playing golf or whatever. You'd have more free time. And that was sort of the dream, you know? Climb the ladder, get to the point where you're not working as much. And apparently, we stopped doing that at some point. So, why is that, Frank?
Well, you know, going through these articles, we've got two that are dealing with this idea of workism. And really, this is afflicting what some would term the millennial generation. And I don't
Another like lousy term. Yeah.
Paul and I don't tend to like categorizations that much. You know, if you have to put a label on it, that's what it is. One of the things I'm seeing here tends to be the trend. This is just me sort of spitballing on the driver behind a lot of this, but I think social media is largely to blame. Think about Facebook and how that's created FOMO, for example, that fear of missing out. Seeing people who are always happy, I know that's had impact on other people's relationships. Oh, look at, they're always doing stuff. You never know about the back end turmoil. And there's been studies that have shown that people who post more on social media, even though they might be posting, oh, our life is perfect, the reality is that they actually have worse connection in their personal life with their significant other, despite what that outward image is being portrayed. This one article here is, why are young people pretending to love work? Well, it's this idea of they're posting on social media. It opens up even in this one article with an Instagram post of the hashtag hustle, or this idea of Never once at the start of my work week, not in the morning coffee shop line, not in the crowded subway commute, not as I begin my bottomless inbox slog email. So let's talk about email. We've got episodes on that. Have I paused, look at the heavens and whispered, thank God it's Monday. That's the opening, because that person's saying, this is insane how this workism is kicked off, but it's all being triggered by what we're seeing in social media posts. Here on this other one that's talking about the religion of workism, cult, right? Mm. Now we're creating a cult.
Cult of workism.
In this case, and it's people posting on social media, talking about their work and all these kinds of things. And I just feel like it's that idea of we're trying to stand out, but at the same time, trying to create community and the misguided aspects of that, I guess. I don't know. That there's more to it than that, but that I think driving some of this weirdness that's going on, because there used to be that idea of, hey, you hit a certain point, you get to enjoy the fruit of your efforts, fruit of your labor.
Yes.
And now you get to take it a little easier. Now we know that CEOs put in long hours and stuff, but some of that's on a golf course in some cases. And while that's work, it's still kind of fun to go out there and bat a ball around or whatever. Club a ball. Swing a club at a ball.
Never played golf. I'm not sure what the terminology is.
I've played a lot in the past, but I haven't in many years at this point. So I would fear what it would look like. I already had a bad slice back then. I'm sure it's like tremendously awful now. But, you know, it's one of those things that I don't get it in some cases why people are doing it to themselves. And I'm sure it's because they're getting those endorphins from the likes and the follows and all those little things that social media is actually designed to do, which is to tap into your sort of that gambling side of things where you go play a slot machine and you win just that 10 cents, even though you spent a dollar already, but you're like, oh my God, I won 10 cents. Let's keep going. Right. And that's what that plays off of. And I think that's a reward mechanism, right? It's a non-monetary reward mechanism. That's probably not working as intended. Best way I can say it.
I don't know if you've ever heard the podcast called The Truth, I think it's called. They had an episode this past week, just kind of parodying that, where there was this ongoing social media campaign or whatever you call it, called like or I'll kill myself. So everyone would end their YouTube video or whatever, like or I'll kill myself. And then people started killing themselves because they didn't get enough likes and stuff. And finally, someone who's in that mindset says, wait a minute. What the hell are we doing? This is insane. how do you not see this is insane? That's an interesting angle. I hadn't really thought about the social media aspect of this.
So you actually tap into something that's said in this one. I'm going to read right from this Atlantic article that was posted. It says there's something slyly dystopian about an economic system that has convinced the most indebted generation in American history to put purpose over paycheck. Indeed, if you were designing a Black Mirror, so Black Mirror being a show on Netflix that talks about technology and sort of that, I don't know, that the fear of...
In a dystopian way.
Yeah, in a dystopian way. I mean, there's some crazy stuff on that show. Black Mirror labor force that encouraged overwork without higher wages. What might you do? Perhaps you'd persuade educated young people that income comes second, that no job is just a job, and that the only real reward from work is the ineffable glow of purpose. It is a diabolical game that creates a prize so tantalizing yet rare that almost nobody wins, but everybody feels obligated to play forever. And again, I feel like this is that thing that's going on, this tech aspect of things. And I will give you guys my general take on Facebook. It's not good.
No.
I don't like Facebook.
Never liked Facebook. History has proven me right.
Right. And if you really look at the psychology behind Facebook and the way they can truly change perspectives incorrectly with false information, this is exactly what I think we're seeing, these really counterintuitive outcomes in what people are doing. Like, we should be working less because of the technology available to us. Yet technology is working against that by creating these, I would say, dangerous attitudes.
I mean, that was the topic of our first real episode, wasn't it? The busyness in the 40-hour work week.
Yeah.
You know, the irony that we should be working less with all this technology. Instead, we're working more.
Don't get me wrong. There are certainly going to be jobs that you're going to be busting butt for, or there might be seasonality in jobs. I mean, thinking about CPAs who have to do tax work going up to April 15th or whatever that deadline. Absolutely. Right.
And there's nothing wrong with wanting to work a lot. I mean, from a person who worked most of my 30s away and 20s away, you know, when you find something you love doing, there's nothing, you do as much of it as you want. It's the, when you find something that you are okay with doing, or it's, you know, it's fine, it's a job. Don't act like you're obsessed with it and then put in 80 hours a week to show the world how obsessed with it you are. Why? To what end? What are you accomplishing?
Well, and I think that's key too, that again, in this sort of Atlantic article here, the author does talk about, and I should find the author's name real quick. The author is Nikki Lowe, staff writer, but here it says,
we'll put it in the show notes,
time for happiness. And the author does say that they're not doing a good job of that themselves. They're guilty in this area too. But the true thing is that you've got to find time for yourself. You got to find work-life balance. I can tell you that if you're going to slog yourself without any downtime, or you work 18 hours a day, and we've talked about this in other episodes, it affects productivity, it affects creativity, it affects happiness, it affects how you are at home, it affects having a home life. If you're working 18 hours a day, there's no way you've got time to devote to somebody else or have somebody else help devote time to you. It's not good. And it's funny because this is a complete tangent, but I was watching HGTV's House Hunters International, and there's an irony there. But this digital nomad, quote unquote, digital nomad, was looking to create a community in Vietnam or Taiwan or something along those lines. It was one of those Pacific Island type nations, or Asia Pacific nations rather. But I don't recall offhand, but it was really funny because he was looking to become a digital nomad. And he was a marketing guy and he was doing social media marketing, blah, blah, blah. But then he wanted to settle down somewhere as a digital nomad and create a community for digital nomads, which I was thinking, doesn't that mean that you're no longer nomadic? That's the irony piece.
Good point.
But neither here nor there, there was that drive to find community. People feel like maybe those clicks, those likes, those shares, those comments and so on are them being a part of a community, but it's so not tangible that it's not really filling a void that you need as basic human level, right? We've kind of not been individual in terms of we can go off and survive on our own independently.
Right.
Our nature as human beings has been to have some type of community. It doesn't need to be big at all. In fact, usually they were quite small, and we would build cities because you need to build cities around need, right? To get food, to get shelter, to get clothing, those sorts of basic necessities. But you got to create a real tangible community. Not a digital community. It's not going to replace somebody's touch, somebody's hug, somebody's, you know, support.
It's community theater.
Right.
It's one of those things that's particularly dangerous, not unlike most drugs, that it scratches the itch. You know, it tells your brain that, yeah, you're getting the stuff you need here. You're getting the community, but you're not really getting the community. So you're simultaneously depriving yourself of a basic human need while fooling yourself into thinking that you are part of some community that's not a real community. But I do think, just so we don't come across as middle-aged guys bagging on these damn kids and their social media, we use social media too, Frank more than me, but we're not like bagging on that as the only cause here. And part of what kind of creeped me out about quote-unquote corporate America when I first started in kind of the finance and accounting realm was this stuff going on, was this like pretending to love work stuff. Like the younger you were, the more... It was coming not from our managers so much as us. You know, we'd have these like employee development things and go watch some like dreadfully boring presentation on the minutiae of some accounting technique that's being used in some department somewhere. And everyone would just go, wow, that's so interesting. I really love that. That's so fascinating. Like, I literally saw you falling asleep, drooling on yourself. Like, that was not fat. Like, what is this constant need to just be so enthusiastic and so like devoted? And as we've talked about before, you know, turning a 20 or 30 hour a week job into a 60 or 70 hour a week job for the same reason. Like, why are we fooling ourselves? And this predates social media. This was back in the late 90s, early 2000s. So I think it's been exacerbated by That word sounds dirty. You know, I feel like I should not use that word.
It's one of my favorite. It's exacerbated it.
I do love that word, but it's been amplified, perhaps, by social media. But I think it was already there to begin with.
You're right. It was there. And I think there's also that idea of youthful energy, too. I mean, as I get older, I certainly can't grind all night anymore. An all-nighter like I once did. I need sleep. I need less sleep than I used to need in some cases, but when I needed to, I could turn it up and be fine, right? You would recover a lot faster. And I think there is something with age that does that to you. But at the same time, we probably shouldn't have some of these behaviors being encouraged the way they are. I think you're right. It's been amplified because now you're seeing it go on a large scale and you're no longer alone, right? You realize you're no longer alone in that because you might not have somebody to look at and go, oh, okay, they're not working at that same time.
Right.
And I think that's one of those dangers. And we're going to talk about this in another episode. We had a listener email us with some really interesting stuff to talk about. And we're going to talk about that in another episode. But one of those ideas is that now we're getting stimuli. It used to be just email, right? I mean, truly, it was email, maybe AOL Instant Messenger. Then we started adding texts. Now we have our mobile phones that now you've got WhatsApp, Instagram, Snapchat, not only your email for work, but your personal email and all these other types of communication devices or apps rather. And you're just getting overstimulated. And you're seeing that there's so many more people probably going through the same stuff. And nobody's taking a moment to reflect on it and go, this sucks. I'm seeing more people's lives through a picture or a video, realizing that it's only 10 seconds maybe.
Yep.
And then you're not seeing the other 23 hours and 50 seconds.
And you're more often than not, the person posting their 10 seconds is not subtly hinting that this is me all the time. I mean, we've all done that. We post the highlight reel, but we kind of act like our whole life is like this.
Right, exactly. That's the danger. That's the challenge. So I think that's something that we should leave our busy bodies to reflect on is think about time you're working. And if you're the manager, for example, think about the time that you're seeing your employees spend on things and maybe try to say, hey, take a break sometimes. It's okay. We're getting things done. Or you're an aspiring manager.
I'm going to evaluate you by the output, not the number of hours you spend killing yourself to produce the output.
Or fake killing yourself just to make it look like you're busting your butt when you don't need to.
Don't reward that behavior.
Yeah. Right. Don't reward that behavior. Exactly. Or if you're an aspiring manager, think about how your actions might be encouraging others. If you want to work a lot of hours and you're enjoying that, go for it. But make sure that you're also being aware of the impact you might be having on others and communicating that with others. And I think that's the key, is that if you're a manager or you're an aspiring manager or aspiring leader, think about the others.
If you're an employee in general.
Yeah.
I mean, like the example I was just giving, your peers can be just as much of a reinforcer of these tendencies as your boss in some cases.
Right.
Even if you're the lowest level of whatever your organization is, you still have peers that you might be influencing in these ways.
Exactly. So just be more aware. I think that's the one thing that we do poorly these days is lack of awareness of others. I see it on the road. People are pulling out. They don't look and see if there's a car there. No. I think that's maybe a symbol or a metaphor for a larger problem is just we're so into our own world that we're not really being as considerate of what others are dealing with. And I think if you're a manager, you're a leader, or you're somebody who's living this lifestyle of, hey, I'm grinding or it's whatever, just maybe take a moment to see if you're having a positive impact on those around you.
It's a good point. I like it.
So anyway, I think that's it for us, folks.
I think so. I'm going to go pick up my daughter at preschool and we're going to go do something that's not work. Probably if it stopped raining, go to the playground.
I've got a faculty meeting. So that's what I'm going to do.
So I'm the slacker. Great.
See, you got to be working, Paul. You got to be putting in that grind.
All right. Never mind. I'm just going to put my kid in front of the TV.
Give him the iPad. Just play games.
Yep.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Reach out to us. If you have anything, if you want to share anything, if you've got tips and tricks that work for you, we want to hear it. We want to share it. We appreciate you listening. Take care, everybody.
Goodbye, folks.
The Busyness Paradox is distributed by Paul Harvey and Frank Butler. Our theme music is adapted from It's Business Time by Jermaine Clements and Brett McKenzie. Our production manager is Justin One Take. We hope you enjoyed this episode, and we'd love to hear from you. Please send questions, comments, or ideas for future episode topics to input@busynessparadox.com or find us on Twitter. Also, be sure to visit our website, busynessparadox.com, to read our blog posts and for links to the articles and other resources mentioned in today's show. Finally, please take a moment to rate and follow or subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, or your preferred podcast provider. It's business.